Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage of Augmented World Expo and also some of the different AI-related discussions that I had leading up to my Socratic dialogue on the future of XR and AI at the end of AWE. Today's episode is with Caitlin Krause, who is a designer, author, educator, and artist who is really focusing a lot on both digital well-being as well as bringing more experiential, embodied, and mindfulness practices into XR, and ultimately not trying to forget that there's the human experience that's embedded into XR itself. And a lot of time there's a focus on the technology and the products, but she's trying to bring those experiential dimensions back into XR. And rather than focusing on us as atomistic individuals, but more of the collaborative aspect of XR. And so all the different ways that XR facilitates these more collaborative, embodied, experiential, and relational dynamics. And so leading up to Augmented World Expo, I had sent Caitlin a number of different podcasts around process philosophy, Alfred North Whitehead. And so she was really taking that all in and still kind of digesting it and in this liminal phase of really integrating all these concepts and ideas. And so the broader XR industry itself was already in this like weird liminal transition phase of things are ending, new things are beginning. And so I invited Caitlin to sit down and have a dialogue around some of the different things that she's thinking about working through. She had a whole experiential session there at Augmented World Expo. And she had made a request before we started recording that we turn it more into a dialogue, less than an interview. And so she also wanted to try to share it 50-50. And so I also wanted to kind of share different insights and aspects of process philosophy, but also working through a lot of the different arguments about AI that I was preparing for throughout the course of my week there at Augmented World Expo with all sorts of different conversations with folks. And so this was a chance to kind of work through some of the more philosophical dimensions of arguments in and around artificial intelligence, but also the future of how we need to move into this philosophical paradigm shift that is more focused on processes and relationships with other people, but also the technology relative to each other. You know, in a lot of ways, AI, I would say, is not in right relationship to the world around it. And that, you know, there's a lot of different arguments around resisting AI and anti-fascist approach to artificial intelligence by Dan McQuillan that is really laying out all these different arguments of saying that, you know, AI as a technology should be considered to be more of a artifact of politics that's being used through the lens of technology, but that there's these political dimensions of the consolidation of wealth and power that need to be seen through a political lens, not just purely through a technological lens, but also a social and relational lens, because the process of production of knowledge includes like all sorts of different technological and sociological processes that are kind of embedded within the data and that relationship of that. And so, yeah, trying not to abstract all that out into some sort of like view from nowhere quantified number, but to preserve the contextual and relational dynamics of how that knowledge is contained within the data set that is being used to train these machine learning technologies in the first place. And so, yeah, try not to forget these deeper relational and contextual dynamics of the technology itself. So, yeah, really dynamic conversation, exploring all these different concepts and ideas. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, Caitlin is putting forth this more optimistic approach for how to preserve the different benefits of the technology that's out there, but also how do we start to get more into right relationship with the technology in a way that would satisfy my own sense of how can this technology be used for the public good in a way that is done in right relationship that doesn't necessarily unduly consolidate wealth and power into the hands of a small number of people. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Caitlin happened on Wednesday, June 17th, 2026 at the Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Krause. I have been in the realm of XR for just about two decades, and I empower meaningful connection. So that's been my real mission statement for over a decade. I founded a company, MindWise, and it started off as a company with mindfulness and design and storytelling, and really grew into this imagination-rich element of wonder. How do we have wonder involved in experience design? XR is this continuum. So I think back in the early days, I used to look at how the form factors of the equipment we're using kind of serve our overall goals and needs to grow in this creative, imagination-rich world. I had been a teacher for over 10 years in middle school and high school, and had also worked at Accenture as a computer programmer, had a lot of background in a mix of technology and art and interactive media. And really, the idea for me about what I do in XR came to me as this idea of a need for a guide who would invite people to focus on the word experience more instead of the products. The products become enablement of experience. So I consider myself a mix of a designer, an author, an educator, and an artist who really believes that right now there's a huge opportunity for humans to tap into their sense of worth and meaning and connect their individual voice more to a collective mission that's leading us into more of a collaboration phase. So that's where I've been thinking lately, Kent, that whether it comes to economy or society, we are in a phase right now that gives us an opportunity to be less individualistic and more allocentric versus egocentric. So a lot of the research and practices that I do are based on those layers of experience and kind of this multifaceted background and training that I've had to then empower that connection, often using XR as a vehicle because it's still the best way I find to transcend.
Nice. And so last year you had a very embodied experiential session you had at AWE, and then you had another session here this year. So what were you wanting to explore in this year's session at AWE?
Thank you for asking. And I have to ask, did you notice any of it? Were you on the floor and saw people? Because this was a mobile session this year, so we were walking around the conference and stopping at different stages and places and doing different exercises. So I didn't know if you saw any part of it before I explain.
No. I heard you talk about it last year that you did this thing where you were kind of walking through the exhibition floor and inviting people to really be present, and then it collected more people following along. But maybe you could just sort of describe what you did this year and how it turned out.
Yeah. So each year is different. And I will name that different content, but some of the same overall journey map. I've led these interactive workshops at places like TED, Main Stage TED in Vancouver as a discovery session. And when I'm doing a workshop like this, it's usually with communities that already want to opt in to that deeper level of engagement. And my intention plays a role in the way that we engage, because basically, in sum, this interactive workshop was all about connection. It was all about people who are at a conference where they're often working with the development of now AI-enabled tools and all kinds of products and, you know, coming from different fields. And yet sometimes it gets so busy that they need a place and space where they're more deeply connected to their own interoception, which is your internal well-being and your body state. And here as XR designers, your proprioception, which basically means your prediction of your body in space and time and how much you're noticing your environment. So for me as a designer, I can have this interactive workshop and develop places, literal spaces in the conference, have a group this year, I think we were between 40 and 50 people, where we gathered together and set an intention to wake up and notice our body state, do some somatic practices. We started with a breathing exercise together. I also recognize that a lot of people might be new to something like mindfulness. So what do these words and labels mean, and how can we strip down the attachment to I'm this or I'm that and just invite, hey, we're all animals. So we started with our animal body state this year, the third year that this has happened, and said, hey, you know, it's not a have to show up, but we get to show up to this place where we're connected to each other. And ironically, those of us who design in 3D and 4D oftentimes find ourselves kind of disconnected because we're sitting and watching something on a stage or thinking about something, and we inadvertently become only creatures from the neck up in our body awareness. So this was a beautiful year because it gave me a chance I like to say the first year when you do something with an audience, it might be just the trial stage. The second year is you level up and you have that refinement of, oh, what worked? What do I want to bring in? And now the third year doing this wellness walk became even deeper than a walk at AWE. It became a really transcendent experience where we followed a frame of the elements and started with the ground and the earth and our dignity. I say this because I know we can talk about the elements because I think about your frameworks, and it was hugely surprising at the initial stage of earth. I was asking people, let's trust each other. Let's opt in. It's not walk the plank. It's invitational. So you need to find your body state and say, how do I want to show up in this practice that might be co-creative? It might end up, and it was, where people were invited to meet someone they didn't know, practice a co-design that involved some digital media. In a short time, we became a cooperative organism, and I was showing a lot of the frameworks in practice that are in my book, Digital Wellbeing, and in a lot of the trainings that I run, and saying to people, you know, this is a live human experience that's always going to be a little bit unexpected, a little bit different, and we can empower ourselves and each other in our grounding, in our water energy, of how we attend to emotion states, in the air of the quality of our imagination, and in the fire of our collective empowerment, and the way that we allow ourselves to be visible in this world of sometimes invisibility. And those theories and frameworks became an active practice. So thank you for asking me to take time to describe it, because it was really transcendent. By the end, you had people not only hugging and sharing how they were feeling about the conference, but saying, oh yeah, I had gone into autopilot. And now one person described it as dropping in. Like, now I feel like I've really dropped into AWE, and I get to have this experience and be here fully.
Yeah, just a couple of weeks ago, we were invited to what was originally going to be an opening keynote panel discussion. And I suggested, why don't we have me give a talk and then you give a talk, and we just kind of share that hour where we each get like a half hour to share what we're thinking about in terms of our frameworks of experiential design. And there is actually quite a lot of overlap between our two talks and approaches. And yeah, I think that was a lot of comments that people had. And then, you know, then there was discussions about AI that happened later, that then there was a aftermath of trying to figure out how to approach AI from kind of a both and perspective of how to integrate and embrace it, but also figure out what kind of like protections or things that need to happen that require collective or political ethical actions. And there's this whole other aspect of the liminality of this moment that feels like there's a lot of endings and a lot of beginnings. And I think this liminality of this uncertainty of where things are at, what's real, what's going to be here in the future, what's kind of an idealistic fantasy in terms of aspirations, but not necessarily grounded in reality. There's this real transition moment that I think we find ourselves collectively in. And so, yeah, I'll just sort of pass it over to you to see like where, yeah, which thread you want to pick up, because there's a lot of things we can start to dig into.
I'm almost, yes. First off, just a micro question from Kent Bai. The transition moment that you're sensing, I think it's layered. This is a liminality that I feel. And in your view, is the transition moment a micro moment? How long is this moment lasting that we are in transition, do you think? And we have a choice about consequence, and not to be in fear factor, but right now, if we are having this liminal moment and it is transitional and we have a chance to enable a really powerful, positive experience for humans, how long is the window open that you see in the transition moment?
Well, I think it's, well, I can, there's cycles upon cycles upon cycles upon cycles from a process philosophy perspective. So there's always things that are getting planted, things that are coming into full bloom, things that are different phases of that. But I think that the one that I'm looking at is like, let's say this moment between 1989 to now is like 1989, the seeds were planted for the internet. That's AOL, CompuServe. There's also like Game Boy that came out. So that's like the beginning of the internet. And then 1999 is sort of like, it's starting to sprout up with like, say, a movie like Revolution OS that describes the first decade of the internet, really built on open source. back in 1989 was Richard Stallman's GPL open source license with a legal framework to be able to have a copyleft sharing that is, how do you create code that is for the people? And so that fueled the first decade of the internet. And then you have Linux that's basically fueling all of that. You also have the matrix of what's true, what's reality, what's illusion, what's delusion, what's the ultimate nature of reality. But you also have the BlackBerry, which launched in like 1999, which is sort of like the disillusion of when we're at work and when we're at home. And then you have all the internet coming into full bloom in like around 2007, a few years before and after, in terms of the iPhone, iOS, and Android, but also social media coming in. And so you have this kind of flowering of like, now we have these devices that are like taking our attention and allowing us to escape into these portals of reality, that we have this escape, this thing that we're all addicted to our cell phones now, but that started in 2007. So the next sort of stop point is like 2014 and 2017. That's the launch of all of the immersive technologies, from the Gear VR, the Oculus Rift, the HTC Vive, the Sony PlayStation, the Microsoft HoloLens, as well as the Magic Leap. So all of those immersive devices happened at that point. That was also when Cambridge Analytica happened. That was also surveillance capitalism. That was also like all of the way that our data being shared on the internet as it comes into full bloom, being weaponized against us in a way that is potentially attacking democracy. And so there started this tech lash at that point, where people were seeing, okay, maybe big tech is a part that we want to be a little bit more skeptical of. And now we cut to now, where the top 8 companies in the world all had some connection to this sort of technological extraction of value of all the information that was on the internet is what AI has been trained on. And so now we're at this phase of kind of starting into this next phase, where AI is sort of where the internet was back in 1989, where we see this kind of boundless potential, where it can have this real emancipatory potential. But we have the dimension of AI that's different than any other technology, that is the consolidation of wealth and power. So you have this decision as to whether or not in 1989, you have the beginning of an open source of people-powered movement of technology being democratized into the hands of everyone. And it was a really amazing emancipatory and liberation sort of moment. But then 2007, you have the beginning of the walled gardens, where you have the app store ecosystem, where all the apps are sort of consolidating all of that wealth and power. The 30% tax basically has a point where all of the biggest tech oligarchs in this moment are fueled by this walled garden mindset. So we have this sort of transition moment right now, where we have to make a decision as to whether or not we want a future that's empowered by open source, or we want a future that's going to be ruled by these tech oligarchs and have techno-feudalism, where all of our technology is like, we can't afford RAM or storage because all the big companies like NVIDIA have bought them all out. And they're sort of have these hyperscaler AI companies that are trying to create this kind of techno-feudalism, where we have to pay for all of our compute and go back to this era of mainframe rather than this area of having our own ownership of our compute. And so there's this real like transition moment right now, where we have to make this decision as to what kind of things are we doing that's going to support this decentralized open source peer-to-peer like empowerment of individuals, and things like GPL license that are copyleft rather than MIT licenses that can be co-opted by big tech companies that then use that to extract value from the entirety of the internet. Or are we going to sort of continue to support these walled garden models of things that are going to be continued extraction of that wealth and value from our collective human labor that is disproportionately being extracted and captured by these big tech companies? So that's sort of like this moment. It's like a 9-year cycles if we go back and look at that. So we have like another 18 years into this moment right now coming into full bloom. It's a moment of planting seeds and really tapping into our creative imagination to sort of see what we want to create. But it's also this moment of how much techno-optimism do we want to have, but how much like pragmatic realism do we want to have to say, are we actually really protected from this democratically backsliding authoritarianism matched with surveillance capitalism to sort of have this, you know, destruction of democracy and everything being ruled by this kind of big brother authoritarianism? So that's sort of the what's at stake, is like this balance between the optimism and the realism of the moment.
And with a theory of change, I'm thinking underneath all of this, because it's been an evolution that's really been based in the beginning on opportunity and connection and this idealism of people seeing that, you know, the choices were really in the early years that you were mapping, prioritizing humans wanting to connect in different ways and express, and that hopefulness. I'm actually seeing, you didn't mention it, but with the onset of the VR adoption is also the opportunity to collect more data that's it's bio-inspired, and it's also this psychographic map that's part of our data imprint. So with that sovereignty that we all hope for, I think the muddy middle is that some people feel intense disillusionment when the initial hope and beauty that they saw in these creative worlds now feels like it's being harvested and people are feeling taken advantage of. So it's naturally a polarizing time. And my concern is that in times of intense polarization, sometimes people pull back into fear. And so the people who could be part of enacting meaningful change either lack the resources to understand context and what's happening. So you need to kind of help people understand and also give, that's what I'm working on right now, some frameworks and also some relational intelligence. Because when I was hearing your story, I actually saw it as a story of relationships. In the beginning 9-year phase, it was the relationship that we had perhaps in a more intimate way with the way we were using our computing, and then the onset of the social network and different relationships that we were building externally that also allowed us to express ourselves more meaningfully and find our cohorts in digital realms. And that's beautiful. And with my work in well-being, I'm always thinking, okay, and there's a certain process of this where the designers were using different algorithms that were tuned toward addiction, because addiction naturally would add more attention and add more engagement. So I'm still weighing right now, because I am a realist, idealist, I'm an optimist, a hopeful person of fierce hope. Right now in this stage of AI, I think it's not going to be as simple as the 9 years. I think we have a smaller window. So I just throw out, hey, what about 2 years? What about 2 years? Because some device adoption is going to be faster. Some of what I'm signaling that is the biometric psychography that, say, AR glasses are going to collect and use, the use cases naturally are going to hit some real walls for people with how much they feel as if they are in the position of power when it comes to their data. And we want, I would like to have an opportunity here to, I really feel with my mission that we began with, that was to empower meaningful human connection and do it through elements of wonder and awe. And side note, by the way, wonder sparks with equal intensity to anger on an emotion spectrum on the opposite side. So this wonder of possibility is predicated upon trust. You can't really go into a state of imagination and wonder if you feel as if you're being taken advantage of, or if you have some kind of fear and a lack of safety. So human safety and well-being has great consequences. And I think it should be baked into every product design and part of everyone's goals, not, oh, we need health and wellness when there's some crisis. This emergent phase right now of transcendence, as you and I talk about, you know, the experience economy moving into this new transformational economy at scale, you know, and I'd love to hear you talk more about that as is coming up in our conversation. If it's going to be transformational, then in this stage, words matter. And yet the words that we have been using need to be rewritten. So I've been thinking a lot about language, which Whitehead refers to, and I'm learning more about this right now. So this is a new liminal state for me. But just speaking, I think our language of the past is not enough for the relational language we need for the future. And when I wrote Digital Wellbeing, I was given an opportunity by the publisher to have the cover be a robot hand and a human hand meeting in the middle. And I said, that's too binary. We need some fractals. This book cover is a colorful cover of different fractals of light. And
it's like in a mandala as well. Yeah. It's in a circle with lots of concentric circles that have different fractal patterning. And so it's a really beautiful kind of mandalic meditation of sort of a circle that has more of a conception of time of like the ecliptic on the zodiac, that has this more of a, you know, Jung has talked about the mandalic sort of meditation, but it has this fullness that the circle represents the whole rather than a duality or binary. It actually kind of represents a unitary type of experience.
And we live in a world where sometimes our words and context, thank you for describing that so well, because I designed this cover myself and then offered it because to me, it felt as if it represented perspectives and perception and how much attachment we've had in the past to thinking that we need to have one frame, one view, one point of reference. And yet zooming out and zooming in, we see right now that we're in a very nonlinear stage where there's a lot of what I see as opportunity to change our change our way of shaping what we had assumed to be the path, because stories matter. Storytelling matters a lot. And I find that the stories that were happening 3 decades ago no longer are serving us for the future. And yet, that small group of people that you mentioned who hold positions of power might not actually be the future state for humanity if we're operating with a long view. So I've heard recently, when there's something that feels like friction, or in a poem that I love by Alberto Rios, he says, when there's an explosion, who's looking the other direction? Yes, the noise matters. We need to look at that. And there's something happening on the other side. There's actually something happening on the other side of this phase. So it's both the decision making in this period of intense importance, and also how can we break it down into both the human stories, what we actually would want to enable when it comes to our intention, meeting our attention practices, and away from that micro level, what's going to be happening in this cosmic long game, where sometimes I feel if we can have that level of transformational thinking, we're already kind of, it's not that right now doesn't matter, but let's just say that we are seeing beyond some of the chaos that is naturally meant to distract us from what actually does matter. And the human impulse is for joy. Human impulse is for senses of humor. So it might sound very ironic, but I'm very into right now having laughter and play as a, almost like as a political act. We need to stay porous and supple and open in a time when it would be natural to be most closed. So then the question is how? How do we get those truths out there for people to understand exactly what you were talking about, which is what's at stake? Let's not go into panic mode. Let's help each other express our curiosities. A lot of people, they'll come to me and say, hey, can you explain more? I'd like to learn about anything from bio practices of how to embrace more well-being, or how spatial computing works, or something on the spectrum. Usually it's either on the spectrum from a very technical aspect, which I can speak to, or it's something that involves mindfulness and well-being. And we have so many attachments to ourselves and the stories we carry. And I love to say to people, come curious, because I'm curious too, about all kinds of other deeper processes of science and art and engagement. And right now, I think we're giving over a lot of our cognitive abilities to AI. And it's really nice to have a space between where we can wrestle with these ideas and see what's coming up for us and be okay not being okay. Because for me, the goal is not to be pacified or to lull into comfort. The goal right now is discernment. How do we wake up and be really discerning about how we're both using AI-enabled engagements and tools and LLMs? Because they're, by the way, usually there's a Dunning-Kruger effect. They're usually created in order to please, whether they're sycophantic or not. They're trying to give a user the answers that a user wants. And a user is over-indexed to trust. And so it's this dance toward a myopia that's not looking at the bigger picture. So I'm asking people right now, yes, let's embrace AI. Let's decide to use it. And let's have some use cases and stories and policy work that really keeps humans at the center of questioning and staying discerning and dwelling in this doubt stage of saying, I'm not going to go gently into that good night and just say yes to things that are mass produced to prioritize consumption. And I'd love to hear what you think about that. And a side note, if you think Whitehead, because we can't interview Whitehead himself, correct?
No, he's passed 1947. So
yeah, he's I'm discovering his works, and his works, just for listeners, Kent has described them as a little inscrutable, like reading the primary text can sometimes be challenging. And so this is a beautiful kind of paradox where sometimes you need to, from my understanding as a beginner, approach Whitehead from side directions like those fractals of light and see how are some different perspectives of people who have been shaped by his work. Could he have predicted these times being so complex? I feel like there's a lot at stake. It seems like Whitehead was living ahead of his time in a lot of the frameworks that he positioned. And even his introduction of the way to approach language and communication theory, how people share stories, how stories can shape culture, not the other way around, but the story is kind of shaping what we assume. And right now, side note, it could be that we're in a process of unlearning all of the things that we had assumed to be the stories of humanity.
Yeah, yeah. In the beginning of the interview, you asked if we could share 50-50. And so I'll sort of explain a few things just to kind of give more context to this moment. Because I do think that both XR and AR are asking us to have a fundamental paradigm shift around the nature of reality. And if you look at modern presence theory, it's all cast in illusion. So if you have the place illusion or plausibility illusion or co-presence illusion or virtual body ownership illusion, all of it is fake. So it's basically, in reductive materialism, it's kind of like gaslighting us to say your experience is not real. Like the most real thing is physicality, this kind of heliocentric view of the world, that it's a view from nowhere. It can be objectively observed. But the only thing we know from our own direct experience is our own experience and subjectivity. And so Whitehead saw this split that happened as a mathematical physicist. He saw the disillusion of the Newtonian paradigm with Einstein. So he saw that from the large scales. And then from the quantum revolution, he was also in the midst of recognizing that. And so he was a mathematical physicist as his background. And so he was also a brilliant mathematician. And so he tried to set all of the foundations of mathematics on logic with Bertrand Russell, with the Principia Mathematica. And that failed because Gödel showed that with any formal system, it can either be consistent or complete, but it can't be both. So there's this fundamental incompleteness with this relationship between the non-Boolean reality of this non-spatial temporal realm of possibility in the actual space, when it gets collapsed into some sort of constraint within the context of mathematics. You have axioms that then you set the axioms, which then sets the boundaries and constraints where you can have these true false statements within the context of those axiomatic systems. So you have these formal systems that you can have truth within the context of that system, but it's within a context of a global non-Boolean space that is many valued and pluralistic, and you can't pin it down. And it's like a many hands on the end. It's not binary, no. And Whitehead called these eternal objects. These are the transcendent realm of ideal forms of Plato. Jung called them archetypes. So there's this kind of archetypal potential realm that Whitehead, sort of solving this dualism between the mind and body, where he says you have this mental pole, but that you also have a physical experience. And so how do you resolve, like, is all of reality made out of matter? Is all of reality made out of mind? And so he's like, no, it's not about space, it's about time. So he's adding the time domain. It's an event ontology where he says to resolve this dualism, you go from the mental pole to the physical pole, and it's a process that goes from one to the other. And
the physical is 3D. The time would be the 4D.
No, the fourth. So that's okay. Einstein. Okay. Einstein is spatializing time in a way that Whitehead actually fundamentally disagreed with. What Whitehead is saying is that time is actually more fundamental than space, that space emerges out of time. So it's more that you have this quantum flux. So for Whitehead, you have this quantum ontology. You cannot have the underlying nature of reality built out of the Lego building blocks of materiality, because you need to have relations of relations. In order to have relations of relations, you need something like category theory, which is different than set theory. Set theory is based upon objects. It's object-oriented. Category theory is a different type of mathematics that's more an algebra of relations. And so it's a more category-theoretic way of looking at the relations of relations. And so for Whitehead...
I'm talking about different code bases, by the way. I'm imagining codes that would fall into this category. Keep going.
Yeah,
Whitehead probably was against his time period, though.
There were a lot of people that...
didn't agree.
Well, there's a lot of people that didn't necessarily understand the implications because the whole philosophical community was going in a different direction. And so he's sort of like coming up with all these different frameworks to sort of understand. Like, he wants to have a philosophy that centers experience as the only thing that we know for sure. And so he's a pan-experientialist. So for him, it's experience all the way down. And so he can look at these things from the mental pole to the physical pole, but he can look at our own experience and then start to project that out into all dimensions of reality, from the lowest levels of reality to the highest levels of reality. There's some degree of agency, embodiment, choice, freedom, but also mental possibilities of what's possible. Then into the physical pole of what's actual, that's the inherited past. And our mental pole is the possibilities of anticipating the future of all the different possibilities that could be possible. So we have our own direct experience of like each moment to moment, we have future of possibilities. We have inheriting of the past of what has been inherited with this kind of fadedness of our life. Then we have an ability to make agency, a free choice or intentions to have some sort of subjective aim or final causation. And then it's all synthesized through our emotions is this kind of prehensive grasping of trying to understand what those possible futures are, inheriting what exists already. And then it's integrating our own agency in terms of what actions we want to take. And so we have this sort of fusion and what he calls concrescence. Of his infinite ontology, the ultimate nature of reality, are these actual occasions or these drops of experience and pulses of emotion, these contrasts of emotion that is the underlying nature of reality itself. So this theory of concrescence, for Whitehead, he's describing this event ontology and having to create all these kind of language. But as I have my experiential design framework, which is trying to describe all this stuff, I've been more recently in discussion with process philosophers, you know, kind of mapping over this kind of elemental framework over into some more of a process relational theory of concrescence. So that's some of the talks I've been giving at a process philosophy conference called Mind at Large recently, where I was talking about this kind of archetypal process and pan-experientialism, but also, yeah, just feels like there's a solid metaphysical foundation where I think that both XR and AI are sort of catalyzing us into this deep paradigm shift that we need to have. And I feel like Whitehead's process philosophy, for all the building blocks of the nature of reality, are processes, relationships, and time is the ultimate nature of reality. And out of that, you have space. So you have the quadrivium, which is the numbers abstractly, that's mathematics. Numbers and time is music. Numbers and space is geometry. And number and space and time is astronomy. So you have this kind of mapping over to the agency, final cause, formal cause, efficient cause, and the material cause are kind of the value, the purpose, the meaning, the feeling, which if the building blocks of reality are not stuff, then for Whitehead, it's time. So within that context of that time, it's this underlying value and meaning and purpose and these deeper archetypal complexes. And you can think about it in music, the chords that are playing that give you a feeling.
Yes. So. I feel like we were meant to talk right now in this very moment about this. I'd like to read you something from the end of the introduction to the book and ask you what you think Whitehead would say about it, or what you would say about it through Whitehead's mind state. It's a time of rapid change right now, so we must also mirror the agility and resilience in staying open with our thinking. We not only look to mentor younger generations, we look to them to teach and show the way. We might feel fear rising up, which is a common reaction to tech discussions, and we invite ourselves to use a phrase, "That's interesting," as we name the experience of curiosity over fear. If we're not unsettled by some of this, then we're not really engaging and grappling with it. As Gertrude Stein has said, "I salute you and I say, I'm not displeased, I am not pleased, I am not pleased, I'm not displeased." This doesn't mean we need to be pessimistic or complaining. It means that there's something at stake and we care. We open up to paradoxes, weigh opposites, and we know there's a space between and areas of convergence. So what is digital well-being? It's opening up. It's a quality of open, a way of being in and out of time. The word open stays with us throughout this book. We've always lived in two worlds: the world of the physical space and the body, and the world of our mind and imagination. Now there's also a third space, the worlds in shared virtual spaces, which are empowered by digital technology. Our worlds and our sense of agency and thriving could be extended, expanded, and elevated in connection that is transformation. They can all become spaces and places where wonder comes alive and where we experience digital well-being by design with imagination. Worlds could open, as do we.
Beautiful. Yeah. There's a number of different connecting points. First, for Whitehead, the universe is being co-constructed moment to moment in a sense that it's an unfolding process that's open for possibility, and that the ultimate nature of reality for Whiteheads is sort of creativity that is at the same level as God, in the sense that he needed to have God to solve his philosophical problem of like, what's the ultimate nature of potential? Who's bounding those potentials? And so you have this co-creative dipolar process where God and creativity are kind of at the same level, which is kind of a beautiful. So a lot of theologians sort of picked up on this. So there's this idea that there's a platonic realm of ideal forms, and that there's this eternal realm that's static and unchanging, but that in order for that to exist, it requires the time domain where it's unfolding and changing. And so there's a sort of like ingression from the mental pole of these eternal objects that are ingressing into reality, but that they're mutually implicative is what...
Eternal, are you uncovering the truth of them as you enact your creative impulse? It feels like a spiritual act then.
Well, there's a sort of like dimensions of truth, beauty, and goodness that have these sort of forms that we can recognize, but they don't exist in absence of in our perceptual reality. So we have to have some sort of experience of them, but there's this way that the eternity doesn't exist then absence of this unfolding dynamic process. And so there's what Kastner, Kaufman, and Epperson have in this paper called Taking Heisenberg's Potentia Seriously, to move to quantum ontology, to sort of ground it into a metaphor where you have these realms of possibility, and then you have the actuality where you have this collapse of the metaphoric wave function into one actual specific instance. It's that one instance that is the physicality of the reality, but I hesitate to say that the physical is the real, because for them, they're saying that the possibilities are also real, just as real. In fact, you can't have the physical reality without that possibility space. So they're saying that it's not mutually exclusive, this mind-body dualism of res extensa and res potentia, that they're actually what they call mutually implicative, that you cannot literally have one without the other, the two sides of the same coin. They are the process moving from this possibility space of the mental pole. So our imagination, and then from the imagination, it sort of grounds into our embodied experience into the physical pole. So one feedback in terms of this third space, I don't know if Whitehead would necessarily recognize it as a new ontological third space, because it's enough to have the realm of possibilities as imagination into the physical reality, because there's always an ingression of the possibility space into the physical reality.
The third space, what I would want to ask Whitehead, who never had the opportunity for metaverse, is that it's the shared space of the collective we. And I'm really curious, I guess the two questions that are totally separate, take whichever one you want, is that AI often right now, I see development toward the idea of embodiment, the idea of giving a body of sensory input to an AI to give it more empathic understanding of a condition of being, some sort of sensory inputs. And I'm wondering what you think about that embodiment factor with AI in mind, if that would enable a dialectic of more of this experience base that Whitehead would point to. And then the second part would be, for me, part of the reason, and people who are here in this conference know it, I fell in love with VR activated by that human engagement together in metaverse spaces. And so this idea constantly throughout my book and my collective research is how much that individuality can both be expressed in our sovereignty and also dissolve into a collective source of effervescence. That's a form of wonder that I feel when I'm in a metaverse space, which is a little bit different than a physical co-shared quote unquote reality. Now I'm using quotes for it. So take those juicy questions anywhere you want, because I just feel like we're working toward a crescendo, and now my appetite is for more.
Yeah. So a couple of things in terms of the collective and individual relationship, but there's also this dynamic between AI and its relationship between the body. And so what I would say about AI is that part of the reason why I think AI is sort of catalyzing this paradigm shift is because AI itself is moving from the non-Boolean to the Boolean. So these Bayesian reasonings of its possibility space is sort of like looking at all these archetypal potentialities, what they call the latent space within the context of AI, taking all of the different data and then having these realms of potential and finding those kind of deeper patterns. There was a paper that was talking about machine intelligence as sort of a form of Neoplatonism. So there's a way in which that there's these platonic ideal forms, but you can just think about it as these relational dynamics that are at these higher dimensional operations that they use mathematically that are then moving from this kind of non-Boolean space into a collapse into whatever the probable next word might be. And so it's demonstrating different aspects of this relationship between the non-Boolean and Boolean. And I'd recommend
narrow creativity major. If it's often just predicting, then it's recursive in my mind.
Well, so there's issues with large language models in terms of limitations of taking the entirety of all the corpus of data and then basically reducing it down to a singular perspective that has no relationality, no contextual information. It's sort of collapsing a lot of the situated knowledges from Donna Haraway, saying that there's unique perspective that I have my own opinion based on my lived experiences, and AI doesn't have any of those lived experiences. So it's sort of like this quintessential Thomas Nagel view from nowhere in a way that doesn't actually have a perspective. But you have, from the Boolean to the non-Boolean, there's a book called Knowledge and Time by Hans Primus that is articulating all these fuzzy logic, non-Boolean logics that are out there, modal logic. There's a whole list of different types of logics that the nature of reality is better described by this non-Boolean to Boolean reality, which I think AI sort of describing that. And I think there's a lot of projection of what that human reality is. But at the end of the day, AI doesn't have any embodied experiences. It has no context. It has no lived experience per se. So it's sort of decontextualized from the body. It's like, you know, there's a lot of this term of intelligence as this word, but Whitehead would talk about that as a sort of fallacy of misplaced concreteness. So Whitehead was a pan-experientialist, not a panpsychist. So there's this idea that panpsychism is like intelligence or mind within the context of matter. But for Whitehead, it's all this kind of experience, and time is the ultimate nature of reality. And so for me, looking at AI, there's a lot of critiques. You know, there's a documentary called Ghost in the Machine, which does a really great job of like tracking the eugenicist history of intelligence, general intelligence, the G factor IQ, and the kind of like this whole talk of general intelligence, also super intelligence, evokes previous discussions of eugenicists who were trying to create this hierarchy of intelligence, and people who are at the bottom of that hierarchy were sterilized. So there's kind of like this really ugly eugenicist history into AI that is kind of adopted into the quantification of intelligence into a number that then is replicated to what we see in this kind of benchmarking mindset that is trying to evaluate the intelligence of something, but it's really all coming from human value and labor and relationality and meaning and context that's sort of extracted in a way that is kind of decontextualizing that.
And it totally goes against the earlier principles where you were talking about what I saw as this nature of creativity and how it's sourced and this idea of, I mean, it's just such an interesting time right now to even judge what a framework would be for intelligence, because as we bring up the emotional side, it being context-driven and experience-driven, we know that there's a human experience to something. And people keep saying to me, side note, there are a lot of side notes, what makes a human special? What makes a human remarkable in this age of AI? But if we were looking at it from this either-or perspective, we'd be in competition. And I personally don't see it as a useful question, because it creates this need to prove worth, to prove ourselves as if we didn't know our meaning and worth already. So right now, the opportunity is to find even more meaning, even more salience in our abilities to find situations, people, sources of mattering, to not just prioritize comfort over everything else. But I think with this introduction of AI, I see people looking to have it embodied to give the idea that it would be, but everything is signaling a human context and framework. And through these introductions of creative context, it just, to me, it comes back to a question about soulfulness and about what could be identified as spirituality, because it's a reason for meaning in the world. And this meaning that we're seeking, again, some of the way that something is built, if it's built on extractive algorithms, it's going to have extractive energy in the design. So even if people say to me, well, wow, I found a source of wonder in my AI, it inevitably, you know, I've had many friends say to me, it started out as something quite fascinating and interesting, and then it became compulsive. And then it became me giving over my sense of wonder and free will. And so right now, I think there's a lot at stake to bring back humanity in the center of the focus, and also to be really compassionate and kind to ourselves, because underneath all of it, and I know we talked about this last time, but I'm very deeply into transmuting emotions of shame and self-blame, or feeling isolated and as if we're in a negative relationship with the tech that we use, to more intentionality and co-creative possibility. And these texts that seem like primary sources, Whitehead, the reason that these frameworks I find fascinating and interesting is they give us an opportunity to switch that lens from a binary perspective of being used at the mercy of what a lot of people say is an inevitable consequence of this ramp up of technology means that, oh, and then humans, as you said, are then on the base layer. But that's within a certain framework of looking at intelligence in a very linear perspective. It's not looking at the perspective of feeling and sensing and dropping into the moments that can be blissful pauses. If the goal is just to be rapid, then great, let's automate and let's systematize and let's do things as fast as possible. But how often has that led to people feeling as if they're actually satisfied? We could be entering a stage where we could have a resource of more time for whatever we define it as, but more time to attend to ourselves and each other. And it might look like a slower dynamic, but we could unlearn into that process of saying, how does it feel to show up in a new world where in the future, maybe approaches to having children will be different. Maybe approaches to healthcare and wellness would be different. Education, if we started to look at things less as a singular sense of the I individual and more as a collective sense, which I also found in my initial reading of Whitehead, it was more collectivism, then seeing from that perception, Kent, I think changes people's perspective less to say, oh, what political party do you fall into? What category do you take? Like, what's your stance? Then it just creates this opportunity for people to talk about their use cases for, well, if nothing had a name, if nothing had an attachment of the story of a past, then let's just create something that would be the new co-creative future that is both human driven and this opportunity. I think it really is a time to translanguage and say, how are we going to be together in a way that supports not me over you, but me and you together? So I think that the people that came before us that are inspiring us would want to be on that ride. Like, I would think Whitehead would want to be here at AWE and kind of co-creating that exploration possibility, but probably asking the hard questions from people like, if this, then that. Like, if you're building with these premises, what's going to play out for humans?
Yeah. Well, I had one thought around this. What's uniquely human is a fundamental question of this moment. And it's a fundamental archetypal complex of like, what is human? What is the machine? What's unique? And I think part of the dynamic of what's happening right now is that the progenitors of AI hype are dehumanizing humans, devaluing what the human is and turning them into a number, saying all the same almond saying your kid is never going to be as smart as this AI. That's totally dehumanizing to say something like that. And at the same time, it's projecting more human qualities onto the technology that doesn't really merit it. And so Emily Embender and Alexana point to a paper by Dr. Johnny Penn called Inventing Intelligence, where he goes into the history of how AI has always been a marketing term to gather more funding from the DoD to sort of consolidate that wealth and power in a way that, when you say it's artificial intelligence, we project onto it what a human intelligence is and what we have in that. But it doesn't actually encompass what a human being is with all these other dimensions of our experience, of our intentions, our feelings, our emotions, our relationality, our meaning, our context. So there's all these things that get collapsed with this double-edged harm of trying to equate AI with humanity. It's a dehumanizing and it's projecting human qualities that don't merit it. So I think that is actually part of a Kuhnian paradigm shift, where the Kuhnian paradigm shift has an existing model. You have an anomaly that's acknowledged. And then you have this model crisis where you have this dehumanization of humans, but also what happens with AI. And you have a, need to have a paradigm shift in order to sort of encompass and have new ways of thinking about it. So it's this kind of dehumanization of this boundary between what is uniquely human and what is not. What can a machine do? It's asking us to have a paradigm shift so that we can understand what it actually means to be human in a way that is this kind of like Thomas Nagel view from nowhere, this kind of objective view. That's what AI can do. Yeah. But what humans do have situated knowledges with our body, our experience, our meaning, our context, our relationships, but also this concept from John Vervaeke called relevance realization, meaning from moment to moment, what's the most relevant thing to sort of do right now? And that comes from sort of Whiteheadian concrescence, which is all these cycles of like what is emerging from all of these things together, from all these memories of the past, these previous inherited things of the anticipation of the future. So being able to navigate the future with the past, with the memory, with the emotions, with our embodied, with our experience, with our relationships and our meaning and our values, all of those are kind of like that relevance realization is basically the orientation phase of the OODA loop of observe, orient, decide, and act. That orientation, that's the prehensive grasping of the future and the past and trying to sort of synthesize everything through our emotions. That is something that AI doesn't do. It has no relevance realization to be able to do that.
We're often doing that if people are thinking this is a complex process. I find we often do that and we're just doing it. We're doing it subconsciously all the time. And it's that synthesis. AI is not doing it. And I think for me, I'm somebody that uses AI. I embrace it in certain ways. And I'm also really deliberate about how I want to use it because I see this, again, I'm hopeful that we have a future. And I wanted to ask you, do you feel the same way? Like there is a future where we have AI enablement. We're here embracing it. We can be techno-rich and really humanist about our processes. And I think this could be a time where we're more explicit about use cases, standards, and including things that inspire people to have that connection in place. And sometimes it is a little bit of caveats or something that would come up as a speed bump when things are too anthropomorphic, because AI, if it's masquerading as human and kind of training toward this adoption and this friction of attachment, that's where I see the real danger, because a human has time and attending to relationships to let them build. And AI that would enhance environments or help something operate more efficiently or perform tasks and help us save time. I think this is great. And we know a lot of our devices are built on, you know, AI operating standards, and a lot of what it's doing is helping humans. So I have an optimistic take on AI as long as it's not representing what is the human domain.
Yeah, I'm going to be on a Socratic debate about the future of immersive tech and taking the provocative position of, I think it's fundamentally unethical to use AI right now in a way that, because we don't have the ethical, moral, political, cultural kind of frameworks in place to be able to really handle the implications of it, that we need to have all these paradigm shifts, that I personally don't use it, because I did an interview with Victorine Van Alphen, who's an artist and philosopher who was doing a piece at IFA Doc Lab, and she said, whenever I use AI, it feels like I have blood on my hands. And so when I use AI, I feel like the same way, where it's not in right relationship to the world around us. And when I think about all of the data extraction, not in right relationship, all of the surveillance capitalism matched with a democratically backsliding authoritarianism moving towards this kind of big brother dystopia, we have the consolidation of wealth and power in a way that you have a handful of tech trillionaire companies and trillionaire individuals that are extracting all this wealth in a way that participating in these models is supporting this kind of system that I think is fundamentally unethical and immoral. And so you have to kind of come up with what kind of ethical and moral system do you have to reason with that. And so you have this choice between utilitarianism, where it's pragmatic, it's useful, and also this kind of human rights approach. And I do have a carve out for artists and people to explore in a way that it's important to know the possibilities and potential, because there's an emancipatory and liberation aspect of AI that is going to be the future of humanity in a way that is going to be empowering. However,
there's also parts of it that help people who don't have access to certain healthcare, certain information. It can be hugely, I'm part of organizations that have the same grappling question. And that's why I'm really interested in your answer of how there's a way beyond this phase, because the access to AI, and it's based on models and companies that right now have ethical problems. And so please say more, because yeah, organizations are using it right now to help people who need to be empowered, and there are no better resources right now in this muddy middle. We need some company to step in the future. I hear you implicitly saying that we need an AI process in the future that is a better model and a better company.
Well, we need privacy laws, for one, in terms of like protecting our cognitive liberty and our sovereignty over our data and our body and our information and our privacy. Without that, we're sort of unconsciously sleepwalking into a dystopic surveillance capitalism meets up with the authoritarian governments of Big Brother, essentially. Like, with the third party doctrine and the existing legal framework of the Fourth Amendment interpretation of the third party doctrine means that any data you give to a third party has no reasonable expectation to remain private, which means the government can get access to it without a warrant, which basically means they have the legal framework to be able to have Palantir basically do all surveillance on all Americans and put that into their decision as to who's going to be on a blacklist to be sent to a gulag, metaphorically, but sometimes literally in terms of ICE. So we have these lack of legal frameworks that are in place to protect us. And without fundamental privacy protections, that's something that is a cultural discussion that we can have a self-regulating type of approach of AI. Without that legal framework, you still have this problem of this regulatory capture of government with big tech that's leading towards this really dark path. So that is like a reality that needs to be aired. Now, everything else, to go back to this moral framework, I'm sure you saw Mark Carney's speech around.
Oh, yeah.
So he has this idea of values-based realism where Canada wants to follow human rights first and follow their values of like following like these principles of dignity and human rights and all these.
He said, yeah. Non-negotiable. These are the first principles. And you, when you have those type of values, they're not conditional.
Right. So there's a priority of those human rights. It's a deontological approach of saying these are our values, but it's mashed on to the realism, the pragmatism. You use it when it's useful or helpful, when you have no other option. And so I think that there's a need to recognize the fundamental utilitarian default moral position of AI, where you use it because it's practical, but it may be useful for you, but who's being harmed? Where is the harm done in the data bias? And if someone who uses that same model, but isn't included in the data set and has a sort of systemic bias that's amplified. So you have an amplification of systemic bias that is amplified in a way that if the human rights is not prioritized, then you have this pragmatism that says that I use it because it's useful and I get value out of it, means that the people who don't get value at it are even more disenfranchised. And so you have to weigh that kind of moral reckoning of what that means to use something that you get benefit out of, but you may be empowered in a way that may be actively disempowering whole swaths of people that are right. Sort of disenfranchised.
And often people say, I was blissfully ignorant. I didn't know that. And now we're bringing things into the light. So more people who would intend on other consequences can't just claim, I wasn't thinking about it. I didn't know about it. Were you saying that IDFA Doc Lab has a solution for this, like a short-term solution workaround? Is there any solutionable. is what I'm trying to work on empowering, by the way. So my project is in development right now, but it's toward this cause that I feel really strongly about.
Well, the Doc Lab is more of the artists, and they're experiencing it and they're seeing how it feels in their body, and they're reporting back. Like mm-hmm. When people use it, they're saying it makes me feel like I have blood on my hands. And so there's this kind of recognition that we're not in right relationship with how the AI is produced and how it's made. And also a lot of the artists are saying, in order for me to do this, I need to work around. And Tamara Shagulu is a Black artist who the exploration that she's been doing, all the ways she has to kind of fight against the AI in order to get this non-racist imagery or imagery that's kind of collapsing the complexity of what she's trying to depict. She has to kind of either train her own models or kind of fight against the main default models. And so there's this way that the artists are just kind of revealing these gaps of where the harm is at. And then it's this sort of this challenge of like the United States not really being in a political context to bring like meaningful regulation on anything. You have the EU that has the AI Act that is actually kind of fighting against, but then you have the tech oligarchs who want to destroy the EU because they're kind of limiting and constraining them. And so you have this Coleridge dilemma where you have to have this Goldilocks window. You don't want to regulate too early to stifle innovation, but you don't want to wait too late for the genies out of the bottle, and you can't really pull it back. And so we're constantly biased towards not stopping innovation and the preference of letting the tech companies do whatever they want. But we're in this phase where that has not seemed to be working so well for democracy. So where do we stand in terms of how to rein this back in? So that's kind of like the fundamental like challenge of, you know, Lessig has this model of the pathetic dot theory where you have these modes of change, where you have the culture, we can talk about it, we can set the context, we can have the values, we can force the politicians, but the politicians ultimately have to set the laws. The laws have to be in place in order to constrain the economy. And then they're building the technological architecture and code. And so there's a nested mirology of the whole as a part where the culture is the most pliable and we can talk about it. But until there's actual meaningful legislation that is constraining this, and the AI Act is a great example of saying, here is harm that is going to be violating human rights in a way that if you're misidentified and you're put in jail, that's going to be a pretty big deal. And they've outlawed all sorts of like policing integrations with AI in the EU, but there's no limitations with that anywhere in the US. And so we have this accelerationist mentality that is kind of amplifying the existing power structures in a way that I think is just fundamentally unethical, in a way that I choose not to participate in that system because I think it's amplifying that harm in a way that I am choosing not to engage. But I think that's important for artists and for the industry to figure out the potentials. However, if we continue to progress with this kind of pragmatist, like I find utility, then it's sort of like going to be violating the human rights. And that's exactly what Mark Carney was saying. We do not want to have this pragmatism of like moving forward of the utilitarian mindset of what ultimately is the dissolution of the rules-based order of what Carney was saying, but it's the dissolution of human rights. And so it's a deprioritization of that. So I think AI is sort of like actively destroying human rights in a way that it's not valued right now. And I think that's a huge problem that has to be addressed culturally, but also legally in a way that we have these protections.
I think with the cultural address, I was recently listening to Yuval Noah Harari talking about stories and culture and how they can shape expectations. So I go back to both this window of opportunity, because it does feel hyper short. It feels like right now, you know, there is this intensity and pressure and a need to be in a mindset to both be deliberate, discerning, and shape some kind of change where people come together and they're more understanding of what's at stake. So how do people understand, especially with, you know, here we're talking about spatial computing, onset of new forms of glasses and form factors and AR being enabled for a lot of people in that landscape. And I just think back to the values driven, a lot of the consequences are not what humans would choose anyway. So the irony is this over priority on race to advance the technology are really only at the company's incentives who are driving it toward profit. And if people knew more of what the conditions are when it comes down to well-being and lifestyle and what actually adds back more joy and a quality of life, nobody would choose that rushing and that onslaught. I think, you know, as far as I know, when people talk with me, they're like, no, we're in this also age of unlearning, reprioritizing. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to look at that just one way. You could still have lifestyles with different values. I actually look at digital well-being as a dynamic construct based on your own individual life. So I don't say seven healthy practices. I say, let's get back to our body state and find what feels most resonant. And so many people are disconnected right now by sensing that the house is on fire, that we don't take the time to slow down and give ourselves back that quality. And so that for me is the primary grappling of each day on an individual and collective practice. How do we both take this time very seriously? And I always talk gravity and levity, take it very seriously. And in the dynamic to enable meaningful change that feels resonant. Here we met and gathered. A group of us at AWE gathered for a morning coffee and meditation. And it was a side event. And it happened about an hour and a half ago. And I thought, oh, you know, at first I was one more thing on the calendar of busyness. And I got there and the people were there. We took time to breathe and slow down. And it sounds like a luxury. And as soon as you start to do things like that, you realize, oh, this is the non-negotiable. In the midst of all of this, yes, we're naming. We do not have the answers. It can feel like a shadow time in the world. Maybe it's a shadow state. And to deny that would be to live in a hypocrisy of feeling that disconnection. I've recently adopted what Parker Palmer has called a Mobius strip, like the... He calls it the interconnected life, where the inside world and the outer world feel very connected, and we no longer have to put on the superhero costumes to go out into the world and fight our battles. Like maybe actually the softer sides of things are starting to seed and take new forms of leadership. So I'm asking people, if you feel a dissonance, lean into that, because that dissonance is a signal that maybe there's something there in that shadow to reform, to plant a new seed, whether it's local, because sometimes we think of things at a very global level and it becomes overwhelming. And I've been thinking locally, relationships, community, like close community, and how, given what Mark Carney was saying and others, how can we really identify what our values are and make those more visible? Because if we're going to map a sea change, we will have players that can help that in an emergent way. I like that you're very deliberate about the AI use and the policies, because to shape the policy is going to be to shape the future. And the invitational strategy I have in mind is to embrace that wonder that lets us detach from a fixed mindset of thinking that we had previous answers that are going to serve to guide us to the future. Maybe as Whitehood would say, it would be an emergent answer that's going to be visible to us if we keep our attention open enough to see it maybe in the field that's on the far periphery. And thank you for sharing this conversation and allowing it to be both poetic and resonant and vibrantly hopeful and also philosophically historical, because sometimes we really over-index for what's happening right here, right now, the next big thing. And we forget that there are a lot of useful models and frameworks that have come from the past that can serve us as guides for this next big step that we have. So thank you, Kent, for making this time come alive for me today, because I always leave the conversations with you feeling like I have more questions and more energy, even more curiosity than I already have. It's a real, real pleasure to be able to sit down and take moments to dive deep with you.
Yeah, thank you. It feels like we're in this collective liminality, and I think just sort of like embracing these transitional moments and kind of really exploring and diving deep. I just want to have a last word for you. Yeah. You have a book that's coming out about poetry that's coming out today.
Yes.
You know, say a few words about that?
Sure. Yeah, poetry is the space between the notes. I love poetry. I'm a writer, so I have multiple books. This book is my 7th published work. I have nonfiction as well as fiction. And this book of poems is called Poems of Root and Light. And the poetry book came out of impulses that I've been having lately between moments to craft poems. And they really feel as if, for me, it's both a mental and physical exercise in the word verse means direction. And so poetry comes as an art form in ways from the ability to see from many angles. So you can talk about the turn of a poem when you have enjambment and the end of a line kind of spills into the next. And I find myself sometimes on the side as I'm weighing ideas, wanting to express in a salient vision of a poem that becomes the crystallization of pure form. And so Poems of Root and Light I've been writing in sequence over the past, just again, more formative. And then the collection became so full that I realized I have a full book of poems. So this book wanted to come out today and be part of AWE because it's about the ability to root and to feel grounded and source that stability and that resilience, and also that curiosity and impulse to seek light, just like trees do, to reach upwards and have that impulse, anti-gravity in certain ways, and seek the light and also co-sense other trees in the forest. So there's a lot of metaphors there, and all of the poems in the book are not about trees or biological. Some of the poetry is about the worlds of the digital and the worlds of digital well-being that I inhabit. And they're all very invitational and explorative in terms of this place and time, which is why the book wanted to be out right now, because we are at a turning point where there is impulse down, impulse up, and in a non-dual way, also extending outwards throughout different fields. So I feel honored as a writer and a poet to be able to express in those forms and share with others. When you think, oh, maybe, you know, what I have to say won't be there for somebody else, you can't imagine there's somebody else that's waiting on the other side, that sometimes you put out a piece of writing and someone comes out and says, hey, that made a difference in my life because you put it out there. So that inspires me as a writer to keep expressing, knowing that there are creative and all kinds of surprising moments when people need it. Mm. So thank you for letting me announce it here at AWE, Kent. It's an honor.
Yeah, and I think a lot of your work at the core is fundamentally relational in the way that you're trying to maintain these connections between people within ourselves, but also between other people. And you're already kind of embodying all these things that, like I said, for me, I found that Whitehead is kind of describing all these things that I already saw centering an experience, focusing on relationality, that I feel like is a part of the fundamental paradigm shift that I think you're embodying in all your work from day to day. So it's really great to hear a little bit more about what you're up to and what you're working on. And then, yeah, congratulations on the launch of your latest book and for taking the time to kind of sink in and surrender to the liminality of the moment and exploring all these topics with me. So thank you.
I'm a yes and. So thank you for the invitation to talk with you, and also every piece that you put out there. It's like having a friend and co-creator in the industry who puts out different ideas. And sometimes you'll say to me, hey, you know, this book is something that might be interesting. And then I read it and I think, oh, thank goodness. So thank you for inviting me to share in these discoveries of these pieces that are gleaming and really help to create the layers that are informing what I build and bring to the world. So thank you, Kent.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast and for keeping the faith for where this industry is going here in the future. I feel like this is a kind of a weird time for everybody in the industry. And if you believe in where this technology may go and that it may be able to bring about positive social change and transformation in the world, then please do consider supporting me here at the Voices of VR podcast, trying to navigate these dimensions of transformation and positive change for where all this might be going. So if you enjoy the coverage that I'm doing here, then please do consider becoming a member at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.